When the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? We know he will, but it's a rhetorical question that was posed, wasn't it? Because it's going to be a time that will try our faith. And even the elect will find it difficult. When we look to the examples of the great men of Scripture, we see that their faith was often tried. Even those that are recorded in the book of Hebrews, in chapter 11, in the faith chapter, you look back at the stories of their lives and you know that there were dark times, there were difficult times when their faith was challenged. And so it's not unusual for any Christian to go through difficult struggles with their faith. Now today, this was the day that we had scheduled the Bible study for up here in Tucson, up in Phoenix, and I had been going through the book of Judges. We were up to the story of Gideon. And so I want to take the time during the sermon today, kind of merge what would have been the Bible study into the sermon today, and let's look at the judgeship and the life of Gideon as it's recorded in Judges chapter 6, and ask the question, what is the main lesson of the story of Gideon for us today? And I think that lesson is faith. I really do. When you read through the life and the account of all that Gideon and the people of Israel experienced during his judgeship, during that time, faith is a repeated theme. You note how often it's referred to and how lacking faith played out in both Israel's life and in Gideon's life personally throughout the story. When we lack faith, it has an impact on our conduct and the fruits of our life. It simply does. And when we have faith, it will have an impact on our life and the fruits of our life. Now, there are other lessons in human nature that are also readily evident as we go through the story of Gideon, but I think this theme of faith is key. So let's start with a little background. Note the location of the events that take place in the story of Gideon's life. It takes place in the northern part of Israel, in the Jezreel Valley, also known as the Esdraelon Valley. It follows the story of Deborah and Barak, who defeated the Canaanites up in the very same territory. Mount Tabor, on the very north edge of the Jezreel Valley, the valley that extends from Mount Carmel that juts out into the Mediterranean Sea, just north of Mount Carmel, there's a valley that begins there, the Mediterranean, and extends all the way to the Jordan Rift Valley on the east side of Israel. And in that valley, very verdant, very it's like a breadbasket area. It's well-watered. It has the Kishon River that flows through it and the Harod River that flows in the opposite direction and it becomes a feeder or a tributary into the Jordan. So it's a breadbasket area. It's also critical for the trade route that crosses the Jezreel Valley. You go from the south and you have to cross the pass, the mountainous pass, where Megiddo kind of is the choke point. And then you enter into the Jezreel Valley, and you have to cross the valley and extend up to the area of Mount Hatzor and then on to Damascus in Syria. And so it was the main train route that went right through there. And along that trade route, if you were in the military of one of the greater nations, the Assyrian nation or the Egyptian nation, the control of these areas was key. Anybody who wanted to control the trade needed to control that general area. And so it saw a lot of action. Deborah and Barak fought the Canaanites there. And as a result of that, they experienced years of peace. But as is common, what happens? After years of peace, people slack off. They relax. Life comes along and they aren't as diligent in their tenacious observance of the ways of God. And the people fell to sin again. And in that very same area, they saw the miraculous intervention and blessing of God to defeat the Canaanites. They were now back to serving the gods of the Amorites. Gideon was called to deliver them. So it's in this very same valley, the Jezreel Valley, that the story of Gideon plays out in the very same territory where just not long before Deborah and Barak had been the instruments of God's deliverance. And Gideon's battle, though, takes place not at the same mountain, Mount Tabor, But just south of Mount Tabor, which is on the northern terminus of the valley, if you go directly south into the main part of the valley, there's another hill called Mount Moreh, and that's where Gideon's battle took place. Right in the middle of that Jezreel Valley. It kind of splits the valley at that point. And this time it takes place against the Midianites and the people from the east. Who are these people from the east? Coming from the other side of the Jordan River, that expansive territory, they would gather, cross the Jordan, swarm through the Jezreel Valley, all the way toward the coast, and then go down the coast as far as Gaza. Why? Because this was the breadbasket territory. This was not the mountains. This is where all the foodstuffs were being produced, the majority of them. And the Midianites were raiders, and they would come in a blitzkrieg type of an attack during the harvest seasons, and they would take all of the harvest, and they would take as many animals as they could, and then they'd retreat back to their territory again after virtually pillaging the breadbasket of Israel. And they did this year after year. They would swarm into the territory from across the Jordan in a huge raiding party, up the Jezreel Valley, down the coastal plain to Gaza, taking all of the harvest and the flocks that they could. And then what did they do with what they couldn't take? They destroyed it, which would leave then Israel weakened and therefore not a threat. And so this was their tactic. Essentially, they were raiding Israel's breadbasket and leaving them impoverished. So that's the story as we pick it up in Judges chapter 1. Chapter 6, verse 1, I'm sorry. The land had rest for 40 years, we're told, after Deborah and Barak. But then in verse 1 of chapter 6, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and so the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. Because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made for themselves the dens, the caves, and the strongholds, which are in the mountains. So they knew that these raiding parties would come through on a regular basis. Knowing that, they made plans. Now, what did the United States do when we were in the Cold War and we were threatened with nuclear attack? We made dens. We called them air raid shelters, right? Nuclear fallout shelters. People would put them in their backyards. And they'd build them under the schools and things like that because they knew the potential was there. And so we took preventive action. Well, Israel was doing the same thing. They were taking preventive action. They said, you know what? Those Midianites are coming back again. And if our fields, if our harvest is in the field, if we don't do something about it, they're going to take it all. So they built dens in the mountains and in caves. And they would try to hide as much as they could, themselves and their stuff, as much as they could in the dens and caves. It was their air raid shelters of the day, I guess. Midian, interestingly, had a history with Israel. They had sustained a pretty severe blow at the time of Moses. I think the memory of that disaster no doubt helped to inflame a certain resentment toward Israel. The Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary alludes to this. And it says that the Midianites were wandering herdsmen. They were called the children of the east. And from their territory east of the Red Sea, where Moab is located, in that territory, they would conduct these ravages or these raids into the land of Israel, kind of similar as the Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown points out, to what even the Bedouin Arabs did for years until fairly recent times when they could rely on oil money. But the Bedouins were a nomadic people that were known for their raiding. They lived in the desert. And so how did they get what they needed? They either traded or they raided. And that's what the Midianites were doing. They were certainly traders, but they were also raiders. And they were swarming into Israel to do that. So this vast horde of Midianites overran Canaan and made a scourge that affected the Israelites. And Israel had tried to hide whatever they could from them in dens and caves in the hillsides. Now, in the valley where they were located, the Jezreel Valley, it was bordered on both sides by fairly steep escarpments that had a number of caves in them that they could augment and build for their hiding places. So continuing, it says in verse 3, "So it was, whenever Israel had sown, that the Midianites would come up, also the Amalekites, and the people of the east would come up against them. And then they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza. And they would leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor donkey." So these caves were important to them, because without them, they'd have nothing left. "For they would come up with their livestock and their tents, coming in as numerous," it says, "as locusts. Both they and their camels were without number, and they would enter the land to destroy it. So Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and guess what the children of Israel did? What they always did when times were hard. What you and I tend to do when times are hard. We cry out to God, don't we? When it gets tough, it seems like we're driven to our knees and we beg for God to deliver us. That's human nature. Israel did it time and again. And you and I do too. Now, we know the example of Israel in the book of Judges is that they would be driven to their knees. They would ask God for deliverance. God would have mercy and send them a deliverer. And then it wouldn't take long before they sloughed off again and fell back into sin. Hopefully, we don't do that as repeatedly as Israel did, but we have to follow, learn from their example, and recognize the tendency that we all have when times are easy to slough off. Verse 7, "It came to pass, when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord because of the Midianites, that the Lord sent a prophet to the children of Israel, who said to them," and this is pretty, these are some pretty harsh words, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of bondage. And I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of all who oppressed you, and drove them from before you, and I gave you their land. And I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites, in whose land you dwell. But you have not obeyed my voice." Now, we don't have the name of this prophet, but he spoke words that were pretty obvious from God to the people. I delivered you from Egypt, I delivered you from the Amalekites, I delivered you from the Amorites, I delivered you from the Canaanites, I delivered you, I delivered you, I delivered you, and I delivered you some more. And I said, just worship me. And you're not. Hard words. Why had they continued to fall back? Why did they fall back this time into sin? Is it just, well, just because, I mean, that's what we do. But let's look at their circumstances. God had allowed, the first time that the Midianites came through, a terrible devastation. And it could have caused a lot of people in Israel at that time to say, whoa, what happened here? I'm serving God, and think I am anyway, maybe not the best I could, but, you know, I get my tithes or offerings or whatever it is. Why would God allow this? And then it happens again. And you get pressure more. And then you've got to live for the whole year on what? You know, what little is left over. And then it happens again. And the pressure is there. And you pray and you ask God for deliverance. And it doesn't seem to come. And before long, you know, it gets discouraging, doesn't it? The pressure is there. And you don't see God responding. And you start to think, well, what good is it to serve God? He's not answering. He's abandoned us anyway. Have you ever gotten to the point in your life where you've prayed about something and prayed about it so much and you wonder, why doesn't God just take care of this? Whether it's a health problem or a financial problem or whatever it might be, you pray about it and you pray about it and you pray about it, and God allows the trial to go on. It can get discouraging, can it? Israel was now 7 years fighting these raids, and I'm certain that many of them would have prayed to God about it and said, God, deliver us, you know, protect us. And, oh, here the Midianites come again. Here come the camels swarming down the valley. Where is God after all? Oh, yeah, God delivered us from Egypt, but he's not here now. And so they got discouraged, and they start casting about for other things. I think we see that even in our own lives when we go through difficult trials. If we don't really stay the course, if we don't continually look to God and his word and his example and say, I know God's there, and stick to it. It's easy to start looking for other things to do. And I think that happened in Israel. They started worshiping other gods. God didn't seem to be very close to them. God seemed distant. We'll see that. Gideon even makes that point. You abandoned us. God left us. He was here once, but he's gone now. And that was the feeling. So if that was their feeling, you know, it's not a big jump, is it, that they started worshiping other gods and doing other things. They didn't stop worshiping. They just stopped worshiping God because God wasn't answering. Sometimes we deal in examples in our lives where God doesn't seem to answer. But we know that God is there. We have to know that God is there. The whole time when Midian was swarming in on those 7 years, was God not there for Israel? Of course he was. And when we seem like God is distant, we have to know that God is there, even though it might not feel that way at the moment. God might have a purpose. He's working out. And we just need to wait, be patient, find out what it is, but continue to do God's will because it's the right thing to do. Because it's what Christian character says we should do. Because it's just the way we should be. No matter what, it's the way we should be. It doesn't matter if there is an immediate benefit for doing it or not. If it is the right thing to do, you do it. It's a hard lesson, but it's one that we have to learn. We cry out to God in hard times just like they did. And we, too, can forget, if we're not careful, him when the times are easy. What had they actually fallen into doing in the meantime? They hadn't actually stopped worshiping entirely. They had just started worshiping, or stopped worshiping God and started worshiping others. Was it that God wasn't capable of protecting them from the Midianites? Of course he was. Is that why God hadn't intervened, blessed them? When Job was in his great trial, was God not able to deliver Job? Is that why he was still in his trial? No. God had a purpose. He was working it out. Job had to see through that time. These people needed to see through that time, learn the lesson, and then go on. God here explained to them, you know my power. Look what I've done in the past. He reminded them of all of that, and yet what had happened? How was their lack of faith being manifested? Isn't that the point? They came to lack the faith they needed, the strength in their faith. And they feared the gods of the Amorites. God said in verse 10, I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But that's exactly what they did. Well, God hasn't intervened for us. We find out later, who were they worshiping? The gods of the Amorites. If God isn't going to intervene for us, maybe if we pray to the Amorites' gods, they'll be merciful to us and we'll be able to get along then. This is the human reasoning that they were falling into. They were compromising. Why do you or I compromise? Why do we make excuses for our lack of faith? That's what they were doing, and, you know, let's be honest, we can sometimes struggle with it too. But we can compromise, we can make excuses for our lack of faith, and then we can cry about things not going right. Isn't that what happens? Oh, things aren't going right. Well, have you compromised? Well, yeah, but still, things aren't going right. That's why I compromised, because things weren't going right. What a bollocked up, topsy-turvy way of thinking that becomes. Now, the Amorites, if we study, find out who they were, find out that they were hillsmen or men of the highlands. It's interesting when you read the Assyrian and Egyptian inscriptions and how they're depicted. On the early Babylonian monuments, all of Syria, including the area of Palestine, was known as the land of the Amorites. And the terms Amorites and Amalekites were used very often synonymously for Canaanites at this time. There are a number of terms that are used similarly. But the Amorites were warlike mountaineers, and they were represented in the Egyptian monuments with fair skin, light hair, blue eyes, aquiline noses, and pointed beards. And they're supposed to have been men of great stature, and we find many of the giants were of the Amalekites. Og is described by Moses as the last or the remnant of the giants. Og and Sihon were independent kings that occupied the territory across the Jordan. And this is the area where the Amalekites were coming from. The Amorites were coming from to swarm in to threaten Israel. Now, so they're swarming in, and God tells them, well, you haven't exactly done your part here, so what are you surprised about? Verse 11, now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash, the Abiezrite, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites. Caves, dens in the cliff faces, and winepresses were all good hiding places for whatever you needed to hide. And here was Gideon hiding, threshing his wheat in the winepress in order to keep it from the Midianites. Now, where is Ophrah? You'll find Ophrah on channel 63 on Cox. No. Ophrah was a little town almost dead center in the Jezreel Valley. At least that's where they think it's located. It's a little bit debated. But it was right along the main trade route that went through the Jezreel. So it was a town that was described as a town of Manasseh, but it's right on the border with Issachar as well. And so some of the maps show that it's actually in Issachar territory, tribal territory. But right on the border there, right in the middle of the Jezreel Valley. It's also sometimes referred to as Ephrah or Ephrata. Village in the valley, it was the village of Joash, Gideon's dad, who was the head apparently of a family of Abiezer, which is one of the families of Gilead across the Jordan Valley, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh. So it was a Manassite town. And there was a notable tree there, it says, an oak. At one time, trees were noted and even taxed, which led at one point in Israelite history of a large denuding of territory, because if you're taxing the trees and you don't want to pay taxes, what do? Cut your trees down. So it's kind of one of those crazy things, but it was a possession, and possessions have historically been taxed, and it represented wealth, and they taxed the wealthy. This is a historical tendency, isn't it? But trees were certainly noted. They provided shade, they provided wealth, and so on. And this one was notable out in the valley. And the angel of the Lord came and sat under this terebinth tree or oak tree in Ophrah that belonged to Joash. It was in his territory. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, the Lord is with you, the Eternal, the YHVH is with you, you mighty man of valor. And I love God's sense of humor. You mighty man of valor, hiding in the wine press. I'm sure that Gideon kind of looked around like, is there another mighty man of valor somewhere here that you're addressing? Hello? It's just me. Who are you talking to? And he said, the Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor. Let me ask you a question. Who said this? It says an angel said this to him. Did Gideon recognize him right away as an angel, as a representative from God? Apparently not. And you see a certain doubt in his mind. This is an individual who's talking to him, who's saying some interesting things that a typical traveler through Ophrah wouldn't necessarily be saying, but he wasn't really sure that it was somebody not just a traveler either. And so you see some confusion or doubt play in Gideon's mind here. Have you ever entertained an angel unawares? Not known. Probably not. You didn't know it right at the start, if you ever did. It's something that you realize later, I wonder if that was, an angel or not. I've had a couple of instances in my life where, looking back on a situation, I think, was that really, just a person, or was God doing something here? It was an interesting story years ago when I was a young man. I went to the feast, and we were staying together, a group of single guys. And none of us had a lot of money. Most of us were college students and things like that. So we were just, you know, cash poor, but trying to do our best. And coming back from an activity in the Poconos, Poconos get really dark at night. There are no lights out in the Poconos, and everything's far. And we were driving back somewhere, I don't remember where, and none of us had any cash left in our pockets. And the one of us that was driving, it was his car, he didn't know if he had enough gas to even get to where we were hoping to get to. And we didn't have money because we'd spent it all, like unwise, not well-planned single guys sometimes do. Anyway, we passed a guy who was hitchhiking on the side of the road, a young guy hitchhiking on the side of the road, and we drove right by him, and then we stopped. We didn't stop, but we started talking in the car and said, you know, that poor guy, it's at night in the Poconos. What are the chances he's going to actually get a ride to where he needs to go? And so we said, we should have picked him up. So we weren't afraid. We were four or five young guys anyway, so if he was not a good guy, we could take care of it. So we turned around anyway to go pick him up. And it seemed like we drove a long way to get back to where this guy was, a lot longer than what any of us remembered. We started asking ourselves, did we miss him? And finally he showed up, and we said, okay, there he is. So we turned around and we picked him up. And we chatted for a little while, asked him where he was going, and he said such and such a street, and it's on the way. So we drove him up and dropped him off where he needed to go. And as he got out, he threw some money into the car and said thanks and stepped out of the car. And we were all so shocked. We were like looking at this cash in our laps going, we can get gas. This is so cool. So we turned to thank him, and he wasn't there. And it was like, what just happened here? Now, maybe he jumped out of the car and ran and hid behind a tree. I don't know. It's possible. But we were all sitting there looking at this cash that was in the hand that we desperately needed and thinking, was that, what just happened? And you think about it afterwards and say, you know, the Bible says that you sometimes entertain angels unaware. Was the reason why we had to drive twice as far to get back to him? Because God was kind of testing us, and, you know, were we going to be hospitable in that way? I'm not encouraging everybody to go out and pick up hitchhikers, by the way. I'm just saying that this happened, okay? But it's one of those interesting things, and you think about it. Gideon was in a situation where here he was talking to somebody, and he wasn't sure. Just like us guys, we weren't sure if that was an angel or not. But God says sometimes it happens. Sometimes you do entertain angels unawares. Think about times in your life. I think it's an interesting thing. There are several cases of this happening in Scripture where a man of God ends up talking with somebody and only realizes later on who it was he was talking to. It's not evident initially. It only becomes something that's realized later during the interaction or even after the interaction. But one of the things I think is notable is that hospitality towards strangers is a conspicuous virtue in the Middle East. You travel through the Middle East, they are conspicuously hospitable to strangers. And I wonder why. Where did that tradition come from? Is it maybe that they know more deeply that there were angels that were often entertained unawares, and you better be hospitable if that's the case? Because it's not good to turn away an angel. You're going to turn away anybody. Don't make it an angel, right? So is that one of the reasons, perhaps, that the tradition of hospitality is such a strong thing there? I don't know. I'm just suggesting. But anyway, this angel shows up. Was it Gabriel? Was it Michael? We'll see soon enough. Note in this case that this angel is revealed in the same way to Gideon as an angel of the Lord was revealed to Joshua before the Battle of Jericho. And as that conversation between Joshua and the angel developed, we find out that the, quote, angel was the leader of the armies of Israel and was what's called a theophany, an appearance of God to man. It was Christ that appeared to Joshua at that occasion. Is this also not just an angel, but is this Christ, Yahweh, that appears to Gideon in the winepress? Just hold the thought and let's read through and we'll see. But he appears in a winepress, to this mighty man of valor. Kind of like Barak, you know, just a couple of chapters earlier. Barak means thunder. This powerful guy who's got to be cajoled into acting to do what he's supposed to do. So here is Gideon, a mighty man of valor who's going to need to be coerced or convinced to do what God wants him to do. He was faithful of a sort, but he still needed a lot of convincing. Verse 13, Gideon said to him, O my Lord, and that term there is Adonai, it's not YHVH, it's, you know, a respectful term, often used to God, but not exclusively. O my Lord, if the Lord is with us, and the second use of the term Lord is YHVH, if God is with us, then why has all of this happened to us? And where are all of the miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, didn't the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has forsaken us, and he has delivered us into the hands of the Midianites. So he knew his biblical history, didn't he? And yet he was struggling with the apparent reality of the situation that seemed to conflict with his knowledge of biblical history. God was powerfully with Israel, delivered them from Egypt. Why won't he deliver us from the Midianites? God was with them, why isn't God with us now? I mean, that was his conclusion. You see, things seem to conflict. Do you ever do that when you're going through a trial? Say, I know God did this and I know God did that, but he's not here now. Why did God leave us? You know, he's abandoned us. That was Gideon's conclusion. God has abandoned us. He's not with us now. Where are the miracles today, we might say? Verse 14. Then the Lord, YHVH, turned to him and said, go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you? Have I not sent you? Now earlier, it said the Lord is with you. And now that same Lord says, have I not sent you? So who was it who looked upon him? YHVH. That's who appeared to Gideon. Verse 15. Gideon seems not so sure. He still doesn't understand who this is. So he said to him, O my Lord, and that's not YHVH. That's Adonai again. So he's confused. How can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. Now, I don't know if this is just, you know, modesty or what, but actually, Joash was the head of the family of the clan that was a significant clan within Manasseh. But sometimes, you know, it's just polite to be humble. So how much did he really feel like he was the smallest of the small, like David in his house? I don't know, but he was of a family of at least some note, as we're going to see a little bit further. So I don't know how much this is false humility or what. Still, I mean, Ophrah is a small village in a very big tribe, and so maybe this is a smaller family. We'll see. Verse 16, and the Lord said to him, surely I will be with you, and you will defeat the Midianites as one man. That must have been a tremendously revealing and encouraging statement. And then Gideon said to him, if now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who talk with me. Now, whenever you think of the story of Gideon, what's the sign you think of? Fleece, wet, dry, that whole story, right? That's not what happens here. That comes later on. When you realize that that fleece thing happens later on, this is a different sign that he's asking for. You realize that Gideon had a number of signs that were given to him from God. It wasn't just once that God said, okay, now do you get it? God had to repeatedly demonstrate to Gideon, yes, it's me, and yes, I'm with you. I'm the one who's saying this. Believe me. Trust me. God is sometimes very patient with us. even to the point where we can frustrate God with how much we try Him with our needing to be encouraged. Gideon wanted a sign, because he wasn't certain, was he, at this point? If I have found favor in your sight, whoever you are, then show me a sign that it's you that are talking to me. You claim to have some kind of authority. He said in verse 18, don't depart until, I'm asking you, I pray you, don't depart until I come to you and bring out of my offering and set it before you. And he said, okay, I'll wait until you come back. Now, this offering, this word is a gift. There are different words that are used for offering. And this is a little significant. So Gideon went in and prepared a young goat and unleavened bread from an ephah of flour. And the meat he put in a basket, and he put the broth in a pot, and he brought them out to him under the terebinth tree and presented them. So this was, he made him wait for a little while. I mean, you got to go slaughter the kid and do all of that stuff. This is a little bit of work involved. And so the angel waited patiently for him as he brought this gift. Barnes notes says that it's my gift or my present. The word is mincha, M-I-N-C-H-A-A, which is used regularly but not exclusively for the meat and drink offerings that are offered to God. But it's also just a gift. So is it an offering to God, or is it just a gift to a respected traveler? I mean, he would see many travelers up and down this major trade route passing through Ophrah, his town. Some of them would be people of renown. So who was this person anyway? Was it a man? Was it an angel? I don't know, but I'm going to give you this ambiguous gift, and I'm going to figure it out. So this was a term used sometimes for the drink offering, not exclusively. But there was a double sense, Barnes notes here, in this offering to God and of a gift to a man. And it suits, Barnes says, the doubt that's in Gideon's mind as to who this visitor might be. But Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggests that the Hebrew word, this meat offering, is the mincha. And the idea probably was to prove by his visitors partaking of this offering who this person would be. It was a test. At least that's what seems to be in Gideon's mind. If this is an angel of God, if this is God here, then he will accept my offering as an offering to God. If it's just a guest, then he'll eat it because he's a guest. So it was a safe thing for Gideon to do, but he was hoping he would be able to see from the results what was going to happen. So he gave them to him there beneath the terebinth tree. Verse 20. And the angel of God said to him, take the meat and the unleavened bread and lay them on this rock and pour out the broth. And so he did. And the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand, and he touched the meat and the unleavened bread. And fire rose out of the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. And the angel of the Lord then departed out of his sight. Poof, bam, gone. It's like that guy that we picked up in Mount Pocono. Threw the money in there and then it was gone. The angel of the Lord devoured the offering with fire and then was gone. I think Gideon got the point. I hope he got the point. Because then Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Lord. And so Gideon said, alas, O Lord God, for I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face. Now you can imagine him. Here he is, he's under the tree, and he realizes that he had just talked to this holy being. And he was doubting in his heart about this whole thing. Was he respectful? And all of a sudden he realized, what, did I just do the right thing? And he blurts out, oh, Lord God, here I did this. And then God answers him. Can you put yourself in Gideon's shoes? He just disappeared. And you blurt this out and he answers you. Where'd he go? Where's the voice coming from? I think of that Bill Cosby routine with God and Noah. There's Noah. Voopa, voopa, saw on away. Noah. Ding. Who is that? Right? I can see Gideon. Who is that? What? Here he is, talking with God And God's departed. He was there, and then he was not, and yet he's still talking to him, because the Lord said to him in verse 23, "Peace be with you. Do not fear. You will not die just because you were in the presence of the angel of the Lord. Don't worry." That's what he was afraid of. So Gideon built an altar there to the Lord, and he called it, "The Lord is peace." And to this day it is still in Ophrah of the Abiezrites, or at least unto the day when these words were written so many thousands of years ago. But imagine this. He was still able to talk to him even after he disappeared, and he was told, "Don't worry, you won't die." But Gideon had witnessed now his first direct miracle, hadn't he? Along with the encouragement to do the right thing, the thing that would take faith to do. Can you imagine being told, "These Midianites who flood in here and look like a locust spread across the plain down below, I'm going to deliver Israel by you." And you sit back and you think, "Yeah, right. That's going to take a little faith, don't you think?" He was told to do the right thing. He was given encouragement. He was given a sign and a miracle, and then said, "Do the right thing." What about us? When we have to face whatever the trial is, that we have to look square in the face and say, "Yep, I'm going to overcome that." God says, "I'm with you." We need to have faith. We need to be able to take courage. We need to gird up our loins and say, "God is with me." Like Gideon. And then go and do the right thing. It can be a very personal and very difficult thing. Verse 25, "Now it came to pass the same night that the Lord said to him, take your father's young bull, the second bull of 7 years old, and tear down the altar of Baal that your father has, and cut down the wooden image that is beside it." That word "wooden image," as it appears in the New King James, is Asherah. What's an Asherah? Asherah is a goddess. So there was an altar of Baal that his father built on his father's territory. And next to the altar of Baal, Baal was the male god of the people there, of the nations, there was an Asherah, which was the female consort of Baal. So God said, "Here's the first thing you're going to do, Gideon. I want you to go destroy that." And Gideon probably sitting there going, "That's on my dad's place. You know what my dad will do to me? He'll take my allowance away. This is my dad's place." Now, think about it. Was his father an apostate? It sounds like it at first blush, doesn't it? I mean, these are Israelites. He's of the family of Manasseh, of Abiezer, and so on. And yet here is an altar of Baal with a wooden statue of Asherah right next to it on his dad's place. Or is it more possible, or is it also possible that his father Joash was something like Aaron when in the wilderness he was cajoled into building the golden calf? Would you say that Aaron was an apostate when he did that? Or was he just kind of weak and went along with the flow? I mean, obviously he was to be blamed for it. Moses blamed him for it. He was held accountable. But was he just abandoning God when he did it? Or was it something that he didn't feel like he had much choice about? You look at the situation, you wonder if it's similar here. Clark's commentary says about this second bullock that some think it was a bullock that was specifically fattened in order to be offered in sacrifice to Baal on this altar. They had set it aside. It wasn't the first bull. It was the second one that they were fattening up and getting ready to offer to Baal. And that may very well be the case, because this second bullock is so distinguished from another that belonged to Gideon's father. As the altar was built on the ground of his father, Joash, it somehow seems to be like it was almost public property, because the people went there as part of their worship to Baal, to Joash's property. So was he a leader of the community? It seems so. So the ox was probably actually reared and fattened at the expense of the men of the village for the purpose of making sacrifice to Baal. Otherwise, why would they be so particularly upset and resent it when it's later on offered to God according to what Gideon was told to do. Why would the people of the town be upset if they hadn't had their hand in it in some way? I have a personal speculation on this whole situation, and that's all it is. But when you look at where Ophrah is located on that main pilgrimage route and travel route, realizing that they had people constantly from the pagan nations all around them going through, I wonder if it wasn't kind of a waypoint where they would expect to be able to make offering to their god for protection. This was the god of the Amorites in the area, and it was the idea that gods were territorial. So if you're in the territory of a particular god, you make an offering to that god while you're passing through his territory for safe passage. And if you're a trading, then you want the god's favor as you go through. So perhaps it was like a toll booth. I don't know. But I can sort of see having something established, people thinking that's what they wanted, and here's Joash saying, well, my property's on the route here, and everybody wants me to do this, and feeling kind of coerced into it. But it's the personal speculation, I'll admit that. But I can see the human nature involved in maybe allowing that to be the case. The word grove is, in the King James, Asherah, as I mentioned, a wooden image or a pillar representing Astarte or Ashereth. It was the goddess and consort to the male Phoenician god Baal. But note what's done in the next verse. God says to tear down that altar to Baal and cut down the wooden image that's beside it and build an altar to the God, to the Lord your God, on top of this rock in the proper arrangement. And take that second bull and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the image that you shall cut down. What's the kindling going to be for the fire? What you just cut down, that wooden image, will be burned up as part of the sacrifice, this offering. So Gideon took 10 men from among his servants, and he did as the Lord had said to him, but because he feared his father's household and the men of the city too much to do it by day, he did it by night. And when the men of the city arose early in the morning, there was the altar of Baal torn down, and the wooden image that was beside it was cut down, and the second bull was being offered on the altar which had been built. And so they said to one another, well, who has done this thing? And when they had inquired and asked, they said, Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing. And the men of the city said to Joash, bring out your son that he might die, because he has torn down the altar of Baal and because he has cut down the wooden image that was beside it. The men of the city, who were they? They were Israelites. They were supposedly the people of the faith, of the covenant, brethren with Joash and with Gideon. They were Israelites, and they were wanting to kill Joash for offering to God, the God of Israel. They wanted to kill an Israelite for doing the right thing. And these were Israelites. And willing to kill a man for defiling an altar to a foreign god and doing the right thing to the God of Israel. How topsy-turvy is that? Verse 31. But Joash, to his credit, and that's why I called into question whether he was truly an apostate, because look at what Joash says now. Joash said to all who stood against him, would you plead for Baal? Would you save Baal? Let the one who would plead for him be put to death by morning. If he is a god, then let him plead for himself, because his altar's been torn down. Oh, poor Baal. He can't defend himself. Kind of really sticks their nose in it and rubs it around a little bit, doesn't he? Therefore, it says, on that day he called him, referring to Gideon, Jerubbaal, saying, let Baal plead against him because he has torn down his altar. So Gideon's nickname now became, let Baal plead. That's what his name meant, Jerubbaal. So he went around for the rest of his life being remembered for this action. We remember him for the whole thing that came out later. But his nickname came from this, that he tore down the altar of Baal and he sacrificed to the Lord God. And if Baal is so great, if Baal is a god, then let Baal plead his cause with Gideon. And every day that Gideon lived was evidence that Baal is nobody. You realize that? His mere continuing existence was testimony of the greatness of God and the nothingness of Baal. Because if Baal was God, I mean, his name was an affront to Baal. Let Baal plead. Go ahead. I dare you. Joash said quite a mouthful, didn't he? And Gideon bore that nickname for the rest of his life. Baal was unable to defend himself. What kind of a god is that? So Joash really kind of stands up here. He does the bold thing. And we note as we read through the rest of the story that it's his family that responds first to Gideon's call to action. Now, why? Was it just because they were a family related? I don't know. It seems to be a basically righteous family to me that was wavering under severe oppression and peer pressure. And when Joash has the opportunity to stand for God, he doesn't hesitate. He does it. He took this chance to make sure that he took his stand for God and against Baal. It's like he's kind of relieved to finally be able to take action. And so Joash and his family respond very quickly when they're called. Verse 33, then all the Midianites and the Amalekites, the people of the east, gathered together, and they crossed over and they encamped in the valley of Jezreel. But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew the trumpet, and the Abiezrites gathered behind him. They were the first ones. And he sent messengers throughout all of Manasseh, who also gathered behind him. And he also sent messengers to Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali, and they came up to meet him. Now, I don't understand why Issachar isn't mentioned. Most maps show that this town is actually in the territory, or at least on the border with Issachar. And yet, they're not even mentioned here in this list. You would think so, because they're right there. So I don't know. I need to study a little more on that. But Gideon calls the nearby tribes, and they respond, and they respond in great numbers. But note who is not called at this time is Ephraim. And we'll get to that a little bit later, because it becomes a source of contention, actually, later on in the story. Verse 36, so Gideon said to God, he blows the trumpet. Here come the Midianites. He blows the trumpet, and people from Asher come, people from Zebulun come, people from Naphtali come, people from Manasseh come, and there's this huge horde of people now. You think you're all ready to go. I mean, he acted in faith, did he not, when he blew the trumpet and sent out that call? Did that not take faith to do that? Sure it did. So why then does he go on to say in verse 36 to God, okay, if you're really going to save Israel by my hand, as you've said, you have gathered all these people, they're all ready, they all know why they're here. Then verse 37, look, this is what I'm going to do here, God, okay? I'm going to put a fleece of wool out on the threshing floor. You remember that threshing floor, okay? If there's dew on the fleece in the morning and dry on the ground all around it, then I'll know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you've said. Now, this is a little late. He's already blown the trumpet and gathered all the people. What's he going to do if this doesn't happen? Is he going to send them all home? That'd be a little embarrassing, don't you think? What happened here? Did he get cold feet? Do we sometimes not get cold feet when we're ready to take action? We have started. Have you ever been in that case where you're all ready? You do the right thing, and then you no sooner start than you start second-guessing yourself and saying, did I just do the right thing? Because, boy, if I didn't do the right thing, I'm in a heap of trouble now. Do you ever feel that way? It's like the first time that you tithed when you didn't have enough money left in the bank account to make sure all your bills were covered, and you went, okay, I'm trusting God. I feel really good about this, and you send your tithe in, and then you think, did I just do the right thing? Okay, God, it's up to you now. And you start second-guessing yourself, don't you? Gideon just did the right thing. But it was an action that took faith. And now it seems like he's going, okay, God, really, I need some encouragement here because this is tough. We can sometimes need that extra boost, can't we, from God. So he says, God, this is what I'd really like to see happen here. If this is wet in the morning and the ground is dry all around it, then I'll know. Then I'll really know. Then I'll be sure, and then I won't have any more questions. Yeah, right. Verse 38, it was so when he rose early the next morning and he squeezed the fleece together that he wrung out dew from the fleece about a bowl full of water. Can you imagine that? This is like the first ShamWow commercial. He pours out, wrings that thing out, and it's amazing how much that all held. So, verse 39 should read that he took up his trumpet, he gathered his armies, he gave them a rousing speech, and off they went, right? Because that's what God asked, that's what he asked God for. This just this one sign. Gideon was just as human as you and I. And he said, well, you know, did you ever try and explain away a miracle by some physical means? Maybe it wasn't God. Maybe that wasn't an angel sent by God, and I just got it confused. And you start second-guessing yourself. And he thought, you know what? Wool absorbs water. And maybe I just waited too long, and the sun came up, and it burned off the dew on the ground, but it was still wet in the wool. Maybe it wasn't God. So I know what I'll do. I'll ask him to do it the other way. So he says in verse 39, Gideon said to God, now don't be angry with me. Really, don't be angry with me, but please let me speak just once more. Let me test, I pray, just once more with this fleece. And let it now be dry only on the fleece, but on the ground let there be dew. Because, you know, there's no way to physically explain that, right? If that happens, there is no other possible explanation. Because that's a cloth, and that's wool, that would hold it. If that wool is dry, okay, that's got to be God. So this is a good test. The first one, I'm not so sure. This is a good test. This one will count. So, please, God, don't mind my lack of faith. If I ask it just once. How many miracles is he going to ask for before he does this thing, after all? He had the miracle, right, with the meat and everything else. God just, fire. Out of nothing, out of a rock. And then, boom, he's gone. Disappearing act. And then he talks to me, and he's not there. I mean, that's three, right in a row. And then he's not killed after he takes down the altar of Baal. In spite of the fact he's wearing the name like a badge on his chest, you know, here, Baal, come get me. He's not killed then. And how many times does God have to tell him? How many times does God sometimes have to tell us? But God did that night what Gideon asked, and it was dry on the fleece only, and there was dew all around on the ground. How tremendously encouraging is that? It's interesting that he has to wait to do all of this now, after he'd already called the people to assemble. Then he got cold feet and needed some reassurance. We need to be bold. We need to act. We need to not hesitate when we know it's the right thing to do. When God says, do this, we need to just do this. God was patient with Gideon, even though he sometimes wanted to look back, like Lot's wife, almost. You know, she looked back and she got turned into a pillar of salt. Gideon, it seems like, looked back, or hesitated at least about doing that. But God was patient with him and worked with him and eventually used him to deliver Israel in a mighty and a powerful way. He knew he was pushing God and God's patience with his lack of faith. But once he was committed, as he finally was, maybe that's then why God later on seemed to test Gideon's faith for real. We'll get into that in part 2 about Gideon. But he had assembled a mighty force. And God said, okay, Gideon, you see this? Do you believe me now? Because I'm going to whittle down that force to next to nothing. And then let's see where your faith is. Have I told you enough? Have I told you enough? I think the lesson of Gideon's life, and we will see it repeated when we follow up on Gideon part 2, is that we need to act on faith. We simply need to act on faith. Take what God says, take what we know, and do what we need to do. God is there. He's assured us of that. And he continues to assure us in spite of our own faithlessness sometimes. But he's there, and he will be with us, and we will conquer in his name if we act on faith. It's the lesson of Gideon. It's a lesson for us today.